So let me begin by establishing a context. What we're going to talk about using the name Gaia is a phenomenon which I think of as the soul of the world. And it's rooted in what really is a hypothesis that the world is a living being. Now, I happen to feel, and hundreds of thousands of other humans throughout history have felt, that it's a hypothesis for which there is ample evidence of its reality. But the one thing we want to be careful about, or at least I want to be careful about, is not to assume that because I can name it and give it a name like Gaia, that equates with understanding it. Because the world soul is, at least to the degree that I've been able to touch into it over the years, a truly complex and vast and not at all a human type of consciousness. It carries within itself the seeds of certain aspects of our humanity. Because after all, human beings are part of the world, part of nature, and we have evolved out of Gaia, so to speak. So there certainly is a way in which we live within this vast consciousness, and it lives in us. But at the same time, so do all the microbes that make up 80% or more of the biomass. So do all the trees and the ferrets and the foxes and the crows and the sparrows and everything, all the millions and millions of species that are part of this living world are also part of Gaia and her consciousness, if I will use the conventional terms and refer to this being in a feminine way. Her consciousness incorporates all that is non-human as well as what is human. So we want to recognize right off the bat that we're dealing with something that is outside our normal range of experience. It's a truly vast consciousness for whom its native environment is the universe, is our local part of the galaxy, the spiral arm in which our solar system exists. And this being is traveling through space at millions of miles per hour. So, you know, it's engaged with an environment of spirit and consciousness that contains beings who are beyond human imagining, beings that are part of the galaxy, part of the cosmos, part of the universe. And I'm not talking here in terms of, in science fiction terms of other civilizations and non-human aliens and spaceships and that kind of thing. I'm just saying that there are vast ranges of consciousness, the uplands of consciousness and life that permeate the universe, that form Gaia's native environment, whereas we are really part of her internal environment, you might say, part of her body. And as I said on Sunday, what we think of as the subtle worlds, as the non-physical dimensions that interact with our physical world, are for Gaia simply part of her auric field or her subtle bodies. So we have there's this great difference in scale. But having said that, It is also true that this consciousness is quite capable of engaging with us, both as the human species and as individuals, in a way that we can comprehend and can recognize, and is perfectly able to appear, if it chooses, to any one of us in human form, just as it could appear to the trees in a arboreal form, or it could appear to a bear in a bear form, or whatever, you know. So there are touch points, there are points of contact, and what we just need to be clear about is that because Gaia might appear to us, or we might experience this being as a kind of human goddess image, that is really just a communication device and is not necessarily a definition of the being with whom we are in touch. It's important to recognize this for another reason, and that is that our innate soul nature is also has its cosmic dimensions, also has its residency, if you wish, in the uplands of consciousness. And so if I'm able to think beyond the constraints of my human form and my everyday human experience and recognize that there are parts of me that don't fall into the human categories of reference and experience, then there are other ways that Gaia can connect with us from soul to soul. And I think that if I recognize this possibility, then Gaia also has the capability of opening me, of heightening my awareness of my transhuman, metahuman aspects as well. So there's a lot that can go on here in relationship to this being. So having said that, let's think for a moment about let's say about Gaia's history, again, to the extent that I am aware of it. So Gaia as a being exists prior to the formation of the world as a physical object in space. So Earth has a history that extends farther back than the 4.5 billion years that is the accepted age of the physical planet. So the Earth has existed as a kind of spiritual and mental domain, as a realm of potentiality and possibility before it began to take form within the solar system as a physical object and a place to begin expressing those possibilities. And at some point, a planetary being like Gaia is, comes forward and acts as an attractor, acts as a point of spiritual and consciousness gravity, if you wish, to begin pulling to itself those lives, those possibilities, those energies, those forces that will begin to constitute the sphere of development which Gaia supervises. Because in essence, what the Earth represents is a kind of a lens through which souls may pass, and in so doing, gain certain capacities, gain certain qualities, gain certain abilities, develop and grow in ways that they might not otherwise. It's often said that Earth is a classroom or a school. This is only partly true, but it is true nonetheless that when an environment, when a sphere of evolution is created, such as the Earth, then it provides opportunities through which a great many soul capacities can be explored and nurtured and developed in an infinite variety of ways. So you could say that Gaia comes forward as a kind of headmaster, headmistress, gardener to create an environment in which seeds of potentiality within the larger universe of souls can be held and can be nurtured and can develop in a variety of ways. And in this process, Gaia begins to take on physical form. Now, I should say, in my understanding, there are many planets or many such spheres of evolution that never take on a physical representation. They remain entirely in the non-physical realm, in the subtle realm, at one level or another. But for whatever reason, Gaia is one of those beings who says, I'm going to create a physical environment because there are certain capacities that will be best developed if that environment comes into being. And so the long history of the physical planet begins. But even while the physical planet is being molded, so to speak, it goes through these billions of years of physical lifelessness. There's nothing on the planet. It's basically molten. It has a gaseous atmosphere that none of us could breathe. But while all that is happening, evolution is taking place in the subtle realms, and there are waves of beings who come in, who live out their lives, which may last for hundreds of thousands or years or millions of years, and then pass on. And many of the beings who remain are those that we would now call the devas and the angels and the formative forces. But we want to understand that these beings, too, are evolving, and there have been waves of them, so that, generally speaking, the devas that came into association with this planet before a biosphere had developed were of a different nature and quality than the devas that have come forward since a biosphere has developed. There are some exceptions to this. For example, Dorothy, years ago was in contact with what she called the Cosmic Angel of Stone. And this is a truly ancient and cosmic entity that is present to this day, because obviously the Earth began initially as a ball of molten rock. And so the Cosmic Angel of Stone was present and active at that time and continues to be to the present time. But you would not have had something like the Deva of the pea plant active at that time. So what you have is a kind of transient population in which souls of various kinds move in, are part of the Earth pattern for a while. They lay down their gifts. They contribute something to the formation of the planet, to its energy field, to its layers of consciousness. They learn whatever they want to learn. They gain whatever they seek to gain, and then they move on. And so Gaia is the organizing identity that holds all that together, that remains constant in the midst of this flowing stream of consciousnesses and souls that move in and through its field of operation. And Gaia is the synthesizing consciousness that has to blend together these differing elements and streams of evolution that come out of the cosmos or that begin to arise out of the planet itself and make sure that its wholeness is maintained so that life can continue in a coherent fashion. So we're, at the very least, we're engaging with a consciousness which, if it dwelt in time in the way we do, would be, I don't know, 5-6 billion years old. So if you're going to go on a date with Gaia, recognize that you're the infant and she has something on you in the age department. So at various points in Gaia's development, just as in our development, a determination is made to say, what can I develop out of my own resources? And what do I need to bring in from the outside? What can I do on my own? And what do I need help accomplishing? In the one case, I bring forward qualities or expressions that originate out of my uniqueness. And this certainly has happened with Gaia. But in the other, I send out a call and say, I need such and such. I need this kind of soul quality. I need this kind of consciousness. I need this kind of energy to come forward and add to the mix and be part of what I'm seeking to craft and create here. And one of the consciousnesses, one of the spheres of consciousness that was called was humanity. Humanity in its cosmic form. So at some point in the Earth's history, by this time, I believe, if I understand it correctly, life had already begun. The seas were rich with unicellular life, which a condition which persisted for a very long time, a billion years or so. But the beginnings of life, the beginnings of atmosphere, of an oxygen atmosphere, were in process. Multicellular life was a potential and was beginning to develop. Somewhere around that time, the call went out for a particular kind of soul, a soul collective that carried a certain consciousness with it, that would be willing to come take part in Gaia's evolution and in the process advance its own evolution. And that sphere, that collective of souls, is what I think of as cosmic humanity. Now, if we were to encounter one of those beings, we would not recognize it as a human being by any modern standards. However, the paradox is that most of us, if not all of us, our souls are part of that ancient collective. What I call our deep soul, our cosmic soul. So here comes this cosmic human soul, and it does not at all look like a human being. What we think of as a human being doesn't. It hasn't taken form yet in the spheres of consciousness. Let me tell you an experience I had a number of years ago that I think may help illustrate this. So I had the opportunity to attend a workshop as a guest of the English teacher, R.J. Stewart, who is a fabulous teacher, a wonderful writer. And as part of this workshop, R.J. asked us to go on a kind of quasi-shamanic journey, a visualized journey to what he called the library, to a place of deep planetary memory. And each of us were to find our own way there. Well, this was actually a place that I had visited a number of times anyway prior to this workshop. So I didn't exactly go there. I went to a place connected to it and found myself standing on what looked like a balcony, a very large balcony, and out from it extended this very long walkway. And the walkway, like a bridge, seemed to extend out into space. It's like I could step off this balcony and I'd be on this walkway, and then I'd be walking away from the planet through outer space. And at the far end, I could see this, what looked at from the distance like a platform, like a gazebo, kind of a platform with pillars and a little structure. And I thought, I want to see what that is. So I went out to it, and in the middle of it, of this platform, was this well. And as I got closer to it, I could look down into the well, and it was like looking into forever. It was like looking into the depths of the universe. It was like this well was a well into the collective wisdom of the cosmos. So I'm looking at this and marveling at it, and I become aware that radiating out from this platform are other spokes or other bridges or pathways, which are obviously heading off to worlds other than the Earth. And along one of them is this being. There comes this being. And as it gets close, what it looks like is the closest thing I can, earth animal I can use to describe it, is that it was like a giant snail. It had a humped back, it had a humped shell, which wasn't exactly a shell, and it had this giant muscular foot that it was moving along, and it had a kind of fleshy part that rose up the way a snail's head does, except that it had a kind of a face, very different from a snail, but not a human face. And it had on something like a harness. I mean, obviously it had on clothing, but it was not like human clothing. And it came up to the well, and it greeted me. We greeted each other, and I'm sure I looked every bit as strange to it as it did to me. But what I felt from it was this profound vibration of being human. I felt that I wasn't in the presence of a snail being or an alien being. I was in the presence of another person, of a creature that shared the same cosmic humanity that I did and that all other earthly human beings did. This was for me a very instructive and profound moment, not just in encountering this being, who identified itself, by the way, as a kind of, if I understood it properly, as a kind of junior priest who was being trained to visit this well and carry knowledge back to his instructors. So it was like I was in the presence of a human being in their early 20s and who was just learning the ropes, so to speak, just in a way, the way I was. So we had that in common. So I tell this story because I want to emphasize that this cosmic humanity that Gaia called to itself could take many forms depending on the planetary environment. And in our case, it took our form, the hominid form that we are so familiar with. Again, there were waves of human souls that came forward, and took incarnation in what we would think of as the subtle realms of the earth, because the physical realm was not as available. And some of these waves have passed on. There are ancient forms of humanity that developed in this world that never took a full physical manifestation in the way that we have, had their own kind of civilizations in their own domains within the subtle bodies of the planet, learned whatever they were learning, and moved on. And the echoes, they have echoes that reverberate to this day. Even in some of our legends, you have the echoes of the ancient titans and the forerunners and the gods that preceded the gods and that kind of thing. But eventually, humanity, as we know it, did develop and began to increasingly incarnate into the physical realm and became a physical species. And at that point, our unique species history truly began. But we have this ancient lineage that goes back through different stages and forms and experiments of humanity, not all of which looked exactly the way that we do. Some were smaller, some were larger, some had different features, and so on. And we have legends of them still in our folklore and myth, partly because some of these early forms of humanity are still with us, but they're not with us in the physical world. They inhabit the etheric part of the planet, the non-physical parts. There are some older forms of humanity that are still going through their evolution. They don't have much to do with us. When we run into them, we say, oh, there's the little folk, or there's, you know, the fairies, or there's this, or there's that. We have different names for them in different cultures. But in part, they are earlier forms of the human experiment or the human manifestation on the planet. And who knows, there may well be forms of humanity that we can't yet anticipate that will take our place at some point in the hopefully not too near future, but in the distant future. So it's important to understand that where Gaia is concerned, the Earth is this very dynamic and evolving arena in which a vast number of consciousnesses are coming and going, learning what they need to learn, and moving on. And so it makes for a very rich and dynamic ecology on both sides of the veil. But when we think of Gaia, we need to think of something that's more than just Mother Nature. It's more than just the life that inhabits the world as we know it today. It's more than just the life, sort of the collective life of the biosphere as we know it today. It's a good deal more than that, actually. And what the biosphere that is currently active in the planet and that we recognize as planetary life is one of several that has existed over the millennia, over the billions of years. So now we come down to our time, and at some point, as I understand this, at some point in the past, but not the terribly distant past. Well, let me back up a moment. Part of the reason that the call went forth to humanity in the first place, to cosmic humanity, there were two reasons, two big reasons. One was for what humanity could offer to the evolution of consciousness. Humanity has the capacity to hold a self-aware consciousness in and to be a point of synthesis. Humanity's great gift, though it's one that we don't express very well yet, is the power to to synthesize various lines of evolution together and to create a wholeness through love. As I say, we're not expressing it very well yet, but it's there as a potential. But the other gift, the other aspect that Gaia had in mind that drew humanity to it was looking ahead into the future when certain what I call stellar forces, or forces originating in the cosmic environment, originating from even vaster consciousnesses that inhabit whole star systems, when those energy fields, those qualities would begin to come to be incorporated into Gaia's subtle bodies, into Gaia's life. And in a way, cosmic humanity was a precursor of that. We came out of those star systems, not with spaceships, we're not talking about ancient astronauts, we're not talking about, aliens landing on the Earth and manipulating the genes of primates. We're talking about events happening at a soul level. So the souls of humanity, all of us, you and me, have a certain affinity, a certain capacity to draw in energies from stellar sources, from beyond the planet, and begin to incorporate them and make them available to Gaian life generally. For this to happen, there comes a point of time when the subtle bodies of Gaia itself begins to shift and alter in order to be receptive to these stellar forces, and they begin to change. The subtle forces of Gaia's body begin to change under the impact of these stellar forces. This is something that does not happen overnight. It happens over hundreds of years of our time. But still, in geological time and planet time, that's fairly quickly. So the idea was humanity would develop certain powers of synthesis, certain powers of connectedness, certain powers of consciousness, which would then allow us at this time to begin to reach out and weave together, form connections with the different layers and levels of Gaian life that would be capable of receiving and holding this outpouring of stellar qualities or stellar energies. Again, I don't really have the right words to describe all this because our words come out of the physical universe, which are not entirely adequate for describing what's happening in the non-physical domain. So in partly what I'm saying has a certain quality and needs to have a certain quality of metaphor about it. But think of it this way. Think of it as a group of beings coming to the planet to learn. They come with certain talent for construction. The planet offers them resources to learn how to build things, but ultimately what they're here to build is a giant radio telescope, if you wish, that can receive impulses coming from beyond the sun, from beyond the planet, from the stellar environment beyond. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves. In order for humanity to be able to do this, it needed to be able to separate to some degree from the biosphere in which it evolved. And so there came a time within the past 10,000 years, really within the past 5,000 years, when human consciousness began to experience a veil between itself and the subtle worlds. And this made possible the development of the kind of individuated consciousness that you and I experience today. The side effects of it, of course, are that we can feel alienated, we can feel separated, we can feel alone. We don't immediately and directly experience the innate connectedness of everything. But we do experience our capacity for individual uniqueness and self-reflection. And the gift of individuality, in this sense, is a very important one, and it gives us a certain degree of freedom. It gives us a power to act in innovative ways and to introduce newness into the planetary system. It also gives us the ability to really mess things up. So it's a risk-reward kind of calculation. In order to produce the kind of highly creative and interactive consciousness that the stellar energies require and that the world requires in order to express fully the sacredness that is at its heart, you have to be able to have a consciousness that is given the gift of freedom and given the gift of learning how to act on its own. But the risk is that the way it may act when it feels isolated or feels cut off can be problematic and can create further isolation and further cutting off. So, and we've seen this in the history of our species. So we come to this moment when, paradoxically, we've developed, we haven't fully developed, but we're close to developing the kind of creative consciousness that is required. But we come with baggage, and we come with habits that work against the coherency and integration that is needed. To put it really simply, we need to act, be able to act out of love. Love for ourselves, love for each other, love for the world, love for nature. And we have that capacity. It certainly has been demonstrated by the great exemplars of our species, Jesus and Buddha and others, many others unknown to history. But we also come with this baggage of separation and fear and all that that leads to. So there's this interesting contradictory dynamic in which we reach out for the world to become part of it again, and we push the world away in order to dominate and control it. And a lot of our domination and control comes out of our fear. It certainly does not come out of our love. So here we are in the early part of the 21st century when we are, as a species, facing, really for the first time as a physical entity, the condition of being a planetary species, where our actions are obviously affecting not just little localities, not just local environments, but the planet as a whole. And we recognize that we actually do have the capacity to wipe out all the higher forms of life and set physical evolution, at least, back millions of years. But we also have the capacity to move forward into something quite unimaginable and powerful. And into this interesting mix has come this modern idea of Gaia, first promulgated by Lovelock and Dr. Lynn Margulis as the Gaia hypothesis, which subsequently has accrued enough scientific evidence for its validity that it is now known as the Gaia theory. And the Gaia theory simply says the Earth is a living being. It doesn't go as far as I'm going. It doesn't talk about it as a being with soul or consciousness or intelligence in the way that I'm talking about it. But at least it's saying, hey, everybody, we're part of this vast living complex, this vast living entity. And And it heightens, it awakens our awareness of the fact that the business as usual that we've followed for the past few centuries and millennia just won't work. It simply won't work as we move into the future. So Gaia comes before us both as a promise and a challenge. And essentially, it asks us to rethink who we are in relationship to the planet. This, I think, is one of the primary functions of the idea of Gaia at the present time. It challenges us to rethink who we are, because really, innately, we are Gaian beings. And we're moving towards seeking to understand and embody a kind of consciousness that is more attuned to the infrastructure and connectedness of life in this world so that we can participate with it in very holistic and co-creative ways. You know, this was one of the important tasks, I believe, of Findhorn, and why Findhorn has become or became at its inception such an important spiritual site, because it really was one of the first major demonstrations of what a Gaian human culture might begin to look like, and was grounded in the idea of human, non-human, interspecies communication, and communication between the physical and non-physical sides of Gaian life. So you had the work with the devas that Dorothy initiated, the work with the nature spirits that Rock represented, the work in the garden. You had all this developing as a demonstration of a new kind of human consciousness, a Gaian consciousness, or we could say a Gaian citizenship. And it's, you know, one can debate how successfully Findhorn has over the years been able to maintain this and to stand for this, to represent it in the world, but it has absolutely made a critical and valuable contribution, and it remains as a kind of touchstone as a living idea of what is possible and of the kind of interaction and cooperation and communication, not just between physical species, but between physical and non-physical dimensions of the world that are needed if a true Gaian citizenship is to develop. So here we are with this interesting moment of crisis. And often when something's trying to be born, there is crisis. When a system is undergoing profound change, it also undergoes a kind of dissolution and disintegration at the same time. So we live in a world in which there's lots of fear, lots of anxiety, lots of challenges, but also a lot of vision and a lot of hope, and a lot of experimentation going on in which people are saying yes to the possibilities of taking on to themselves a Gaian identity, saying, I am part of the livingness of this world, and I now need to explore what that means. What does it mean for me to love this world, to love the planet? What does it mean for me to love myself, to love my body, my mind, my heart, to love each other, to look at how love forms connections? You know, all of this has been religious talk in the past, and philosophical talk, and moral talk, and ethical talk. But what it's becoming is biological talk, ecological talk. It absolutely has to shift out of the realm of religion and spirituality into the practical dimensions of love is a tool by which I form the connections that allow the spirit of Gaia to be made manifest in the moment. That allows my greater spirit to be made manifest in the moment. Whether I speak of that as allowing sacredness to manifest or the wholeness of the planet to manifest, the words don't matter so much. What does matter is that we begin to recognize that we have the capacity to do this, and this is the time when we're being called upon to do it and to discover what our particular, what our species can rise to. If you look at the news, it becomes really evident the depth to which our species can sink. But the news is not going to tell you or me what the heights are to which we can arise. That has to spread by word of mouth, because that is basically the just one of the few mediums left. And of course, nowadays, word of mouth means social media as well, and Twitter, and you know, all the ways that we have to speak to each other. But we need to be able to say, I have these experiences. I stand in this relationship to a living world. Yes, I believe in fairies. I have no idea what a fairy is. I may never have experienced one, but let me just hypothesize that a fairy represents some aspect of Gaian life that is engaged with the nurturing and vitality and health of the planet. And so I want to think of fairies as single cellular beings existing in the inner, you know, like the bacteria that fix nitrogen at the roots of plants so that they can feed and grow. I don't have to project my anthropomorphic images into the subtle worlds in order to engage with them. On the other hand, that might be a lovely way for me to engage with them. But nevertheless, at some point, I need to be able to say there is a reality that I can engage with that exists in a non-physical way that's part of the total life of Gaia. And if I'm going to be a Gaian citizen, I need to learn how to connect with it in the same way I want to learn how to connect with the physical aspects of the world around me in loving and helpful ways. So a lot is being asked of us. You know, we live in the midst of a culture that has been one of the most determinedly and aggressively materialistic and reductionist cultures in the history of humanity. And we live in the midst of civilizations that are now being severely challenged by both climate change and by social forces and economic forces. We live in a world that's, you know, cracking up around us, and that doesn't believe it's cracking up around us, or thinks that the cracks must be cracks of doom because the only thing that exists is the material that's being cracked. What the world doesn't quite understand, but what we need to understand, is that there's our whole other world of substance underneath the cracks. And it's that world that's seeking to be born in the same way that we would say that there's a chicken in the egg, and that the cracking of the egg is not the doom of the egg, but the birth of the chicken. So to undertake a Gaian consciousness at this time is to be willing to explore in one's attitudes and behavior beyond the confines of what's called normal consensual reality. Finhorn was one of the first places to begin to do this in this specific way in relationship to nature and to the forces of nature. But now it's spread, and many people are doing it throughout the world. And it doesn't have to be just with nature. How do I relate to the life within my house, within the walls, within the floor, within the sofas, within the chairs? You know, we part of what Gaia means is that I begin to understand the ubiquitousness of life, that life is not confined just to organic creatures, but is a quality that permeates everything. And once I begin to grasp that, as indeed many of our indigenous forebears and ancestors have always grasped it, then a whole new world begins to open up, not just a world of curiosity, but a world that I can relate to, a world that I can begin to partner with. And perhaps that is one of the essential ingredients of a Gaian consciousness at the moment, is that it is a partnering consciousness. Finhorn took a step in this direction with its work of partnering with the nature spirits and with the devas and the angels of nature. But really, we're asked to partner with everything, with the life within everything, to partner with each other, to partner with our tools, to partner with our technology, to partner with our buildings, as well as to partner with the land and the trees and the water and the air and all the creatures that live within them. So if I begin to want to move towards a Gaian awareness, it's more than just saying, well, I'm going to have nice meditations in nature and talk to Mother Nature. I'm going to be in touch with this lovely feminine goddess figure who loves me, and this is really very sweet. But Gaia is so much more than that, and Gaia can be awesomely terrible and fearful in its strangeness and in its non-humanness. And it can be awesomely lovely and embracing in its humanness, but it's the whole package. And we can't say yes to one and no to the other. That our task now is to see ourselves not simply as stewards of the earth or as its custodians, but as its partners, partners with all the forms of Gaian life, whether it's organic or inorganic, physical or non-physical, human or non-human. This is what we're called to.